Well, it's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. Uncle Dennis here with the Earth First Update. All the environmental news you can use. And let's start off with some really, really, really good news from up north. Put that one out of order there. Eco-prisoner Jeffrey Lures has been released from prison. Jeff Lures, political prisoner, environmental activist, was released from the Columbia River Correctional Institution yesterday morning after serving 9.5 years. Lures was originally sentenced in 2001 to 22 years and 8 months for the politically motivated arson of 3 SUVs at a car dealership in Eugene, Oregon. However, this sentence was deemed grossly disproportionate to the damage sustained by the car dealership and was condemned by legal professionals, human rights groups, and activists worldwide. At an appeal hearing in 2007, it was ruled that Lures' original sentence was illegal and was consequently reduced to 10 years. And, of course, he got off a little early for good behavior. Lures' release comes after what Oregon Department of Corrections described as a mistake when they released him early on October 20th of this year. After a few hours of freedom, Lures was taken back into custody in Eugene after the state agency reversed its decision and determined he did not qualify under the new House Bill 3508 for an additional 10% reduction in sentence. Department of Corrections' gross incompetence in this situation and the emotional toll borne by his family and loved ones is just one of the many examples of the distressing levels of bureaucratic impropriety that Lures has endured during his years behind bars. Upon his release, Mr. Lures stated, "My last 9.5 years have been difficult at best. I have witnessed things in prison that I will carry with me for the rest of my life. I have endured hardship and loss. Without a doubt, this experience has changed me. What hasn't changed is my commitment to the environment and social justice. I would like to thank all the people who have supported me throughout the years, especially the dedicated few who worked tirelessly to get me out of prison. I look forward to spending time with my loved ones and continuing my education as well as continuing my activism." Emphasis is mine. During his time in prison, 7 of which were served in maximum security, Lures has maintained his activism by writing about environmental and social justice issues. In particular, he has continued to bring attention to the specter of human-induced climate change, the cause that motivated Lures to set fire to 3 SUVs in 2000. Since his original sentencing, awareness of climate change has become omnipresent. It seems ironic that Lures has been released during the Copenhagen Climate Summit, where world leaders are converging around the need for extreme action to be taken on global emission issues. If you want more information, go to www.freejefflures, that's FREEJEFFLUERS.org, and we're really thankful for that. Here's a little background. On June 21st, 2001, 23-year-old forest defense activist Jeffrey Free Lures was sentenced to 22 years and 8 months in prison for the burning of 3 SUVs in Eugene, Oregon. In an attempt to make a statement about global warming, Jeff and his co-defendant, Craig Critter Marshall, set fire to 3 SUVs at a Eugene car dealership, causing minor property damage. Their stated purpose was to raise awareness about global warming and the role that SUVs play in that process. No one was hurt in the action, nor was that the intent. An arson specialist at trial confirmed that the action did not pose any threat to people based on its size and distance from any fuel source. Despite the fact that this action hurt no one, caused only $40,000 in damage, and the cars themselves were later fixed up and resold, Jeff was sent to prison for a sentence considerably longer than those convicted of murder, kidnapping, or rape in Oregon and around the country. Amnesty International declared Jeff a political prisoner based on the egregious disparity in his sentence. Okay, we don't need to read the rest of that. And court rules that Oregon forest protester law is unconstitutional. Forest defenders in Oregon won a major victory at the Oregon Court of Appeals defending the constitutional right to protest by arguing that a state law is unconstitutional under the federal constitution. The court struck down the statute in its entirety. The state statute at issue, Oregon Resource ORS 164.886, entitled Interfering with Agricultural Operations, was enacted in 1999 to discourage demonstrators from protesting against controversial timber sales in Oregon. It stated that if a person hindered, obstructed, or impaired an agricultural operation, they were guilty of a Class A misdemeanor crime, and this has been used to prosecute dozens and dozens of nonviolent forest defense activists. The statute contained an exception to those prohibitions if the protesters were engaged in a labor dispute. 99% of all state prosecutions utilizing this statute were against nonviolent protesters exercising their First Amendment rights. The court ruled that the law violated their First Amendment rights under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and struck down the law in its entirety. This is a great victory for activists in Oregon and affirms that the Constitution is still alive and kicking, said Lauren Regan, staff attorney and director of the Civil Liberties Defense Center. In an era when activists are being maligned as terrorists, it is very important that repressive laws like this one and other eco-terror laws are challenged and beaten from the law books as a patent disgrace to our constitutional rights and liberties. We are grateful to our courageous clients who place their liberty on the line in defense of irretrievable forests, rivers, and wildlife, and hope that this ruling will be viewed as an affirmation of the critical importance of the right to dissent holds in our democracy. The CLDC argued, and the court agreed, that a person peacefully picketing against labor or logging practices on public or private land could, under the definitions contained in the law, be attempting to obstruct an agricultural practice by another person on that person's property by attempting to convince the person, the person's employees, or the general public to alter the offensive practice, and that the law was, thus, factually unconstitutional in all applications. The ruling that the entire statute was unconstitutional, the court stated, had the legislature known that a bill criminalizing all obstructions, impairments, and hindrances of agricultural operations also implicated serious constitutional questions, it would have chosen to avoid the issue entirely, particularly in light of the fact that the conduct at which the statute was primarily directed, vandalism, property destruction, etc., is already prohibited by existing statutes. One of the appellants, George Sexton, a conservation director who was arrested at the infamous Biscuit timber sales, added, "It is heartening that the 14th Amendment prohibits overzealous Josephine County prosecutors from making criminals out of courageous citizens who peacefully put their bodies between the log trucks and the illegal old-growth logging frenzy of public lands under the Bush administration." And thanks to the attorneys, Lauren Regan, Misha Dunlap English, and Kenneth Kruschner, for this hard-fought victory. And here's the Buffalo Field Campaign update from the field. In an attempt to demonstrate how well he has represented Montana's cattle industry, Montana Governor Brian Schweitzer proudly spoke the following words on Friday, December 11th, during a speech at the Montana Stock Growers Association's annual convention. Quote, "No governor in Montana history has sent more bison to slaughter than this governor," unquote. Schweitzer alone claims the blood prize that belongs not just to Montana, but also to Yellowstone National Park. Together, Schweitzer and Yellowstone Superintendent Suzanne Lewis, carrying out the Interagency Bison Management Plan, are responsible for the deaths of thousands of America's last wild buffalo. And for what? Schweitzer failed to remind the stock growers that despite the unwarranted harassment and slaughter of these last wild bison, Montana still lost its brucellosis-free status and the buffalo had nothing to do with it. Schweitzer's statement truly represents the actions of a state that exploits the image of wild bison as a tourist attraction, while simultaneously dipping into the federal treasury to fund the slaughter of buffalo. Schweitzer has nothing to crow about because he has failed miserably on this issue. He has failed the people who put him in office, he has failed the buffalo, and he has failed Montana's livestock industry. Well, the snow has finally come to West Yellowstone. Volunteers are now out on skis and snowshoes each day in search of bison. The snow always adds an element of peace and tranquility at this time of year. However, snow can also assist hunters in finding their prey. But one cannot find what is not there, and there are currently no bison in Montana. This absence, or emptiness, always feels bittersweet. Not wanting to witness the unnecessary hazing, shooting, and slaughter that the bison endure whenever they step out of the park, we are thankful that they remain on their summer ranges in Yellowstone's interior. Yet the landscape feels empty without them, and we wish our species could learn to coexist with this majestic native species. The sentiment behind Governor Schweitzer's recent boast directly contradicts his campaign promises to show greater tolerance for bison. Such contradictions have become the norm as we watch year after year as the National Park Service slaughters thousands of bison the American people have entrusted the agency with protecting. What I find really sad is that at no time can bison simply be their big, beautiful selves on their native Montana habitat because we, the people, won't let them. Bison restoration is here in the hooves of bison. And if you'd like to help or participate in the Buffalo Field Campaign, I urge you to visit their website at www.buffalofieldcampaign.org and check out what it takes to be a volunteer and what they possibly could use in the way of donations. If you'd like to send them a donation, please address it to Buffalo Field Campaign, P.O. Box 957, West Yellowstone, Montana. Their zip code 59758. And if you are a volunteer or you're going to visit, please call before you do. Their number is 406-646-0070. And do remember the Buffalo Field Campaign is the only group working in the field every day in defense of the last wild buffalo in the United States. And here in California, anglers are advised to avoid endangered coho salmon. Spurred on by recent rains, endangered coho salmon are returning to the Northern California rivers to spawn, the Department of Fish and Game reports. In efforts to protect and ensure the safety of the returning coho, conservation groups and fishery managers are conducting an educational campaign to ensure that steelhead anglers can differentiate between a coho and a steelhead trout. Because coho salmon can be easily mistaken for steelhead by a novice or uninformed angler, it's imperative that we make every effort to educate anglers about the differences, said Brett Wilson, senior hatchery supervisor for Department of Fish and Game's Bay Delta region. Angler cooperation is vital to our efforts to replenish this diminishing species, which was once commonly found in these waters. Hatchery-reared steelhead trout and coho salmon are easily mistaken for each other because they are similar in size, and they both have a clipped adipose fin. Last year, an endangered coho salmon was entered in a local fishing contest by an angler who mistakenly thought it was a large steelhead. Kent McIntosh, Northern California president of Trout Unlimited, said that his organization will be placing identification signs showing the differences between coho and steelhead at popular fishing areas along the Russian River. On weekends, Trout Unlimited personnel, Department of Fish and Game wardens, and the Sonoma County Water Agency biologists will make personal contact with anglers fishing in the river, showing them pictures and ensuring that they can accurately identify each species. The Russian River coho salmon population faced near extinction in 2000. In an effort to reestablish the listed coho species in the Russian River watershed, the Russian River coho salmon captive broodstock program was launched the following year. The program, which oversees the spawning of captive-reared wild coho broodstock, produced 92,000 fingerling coho salmon that were returned to the tributaries of the Russian River last year. Most of the coho salmon returning to spawn this winter were hand-raised in the broodstock program. They were released in small tributaries of the Russian River in 2007 and have spent the last 2 years in the ocean before returning as adults to spawn. The Sonoma County Water Agency has a video counting station at Mirabel Dam that provides an account of most fish returning to the upper reaches of the Russian River. Most of the coho reared at Warm Springs Hatchery returned to spawn in tributaries located below the video station and thus are not counted by it. However, four coho salmon have been recorded passing over the dam, and a fifth coho was recently found dead on the riverbank. In addition to the five coho, 1,770 Chinook salmon and 30 steelhead have been recorded at the video station since October. Weekly counts of video of salmon and steelhead are provided online at the following website, www.scwa.ca.gov/Chinook. That's C-H-I-N-O-O-K. Once again, that website, www.scwa.ca.gov/Chinook. Chinook, and that's really good to hear that there are some salmon returning to the Russian River. And now let's turn to the forest update for December, prepared by Jody Frediani, the forestry consultant for the Santa Cruz Group of the Ventana Chapter of the Sierra Club. And Soquel Demonstration State Forest has prepared two THPs for Soquel Creek. The Soquel Demonstration State Forest has submitted a 201-acre timber harvest plan for the same area as their 2004 plan, which was ultimately withdrawn. That's the one where they allowed a CDF training class to fell a bunch of redwoods in the plan area while the plan was still under review. And SDSF insisted on the need to fell an old-growth redwood, even though the enabling legislation and management plan prohibit felling old growth for any reason. The RPF got his hand slapped, that is, he got put on probation for the illegal cutting. He has now submitted a new plan, which we believe is a replay of the earlier THP with some changes that have been required by Cal Fire. An option plan, for instance, then this plan is also located on the east branch of Soquel Creek. The registered professional forester is Cal Fire's employee Ed Ori, who was formerly a forester for Pacific Lumber. There are two sets of first review questions for this plan. Interestingly, the original plan proposed a monstrous new road, and that's still being proposed with some changes, but the new first review team questions want to know why more cable yarding isn't being considered. It's a good question, of course. I'm having a hard time understanding why a Cal Fire forester doesn't get all the questions answered prior to submission. He's got the whole agency to go to for assistance, and it's their property to manage. Other problems identified include multiple pages stating that coho do not exist, while elsewhere in the plan it states that they were found in Soquel Creek in 2008. Apparently, all the applicable rules for watersheds with coho have not been identified as being applicable. Wrong California red-legged frog guidelines have been referenced. Incorrect info about the presence of western pond turtles was noted by the Department of Fish and Game. And no protocol for identifying raptors was included either, as is generally required by Department of Fish and Game. But I do not know that Ed Ori gets out there with the mountain bike community creating trail, as photos exist online of him hard at work. Lots of geological issues still need to be addressed, and the plan neglects to mention the previous plan, which was withdrawn. The second SDSF plan, approximately 150 acres, has been noticed in the newspaper but has not yet been submitted to Cal Fire. It's been prepared by a different Cal Fire registered professional forester from Fresno, and is also located on the east branch of Soquel Creek. We'll keep you updated on that one. And Red Tree Properties has submitted Timber Harvest Plan 1-09-091, San Mateo, Santa Cruz County, on November 11th. The pre-harvest inspection was held December 10th. The plan straddles the San Mateo and Santa Cruz County line and is in the Pescadero Creek and Waterman Creek area. Both creeks flow through the plan area, and Matt Bissell is the registered professional forester. And there's a new Redwood Empire timber harvest plan in Boulder Creek. They submitted a 120-acre THP entitled 1-09-098-SCR on December 3rd for the lands of Roger Birch, Mildred Holmes, and Redwood Empire sawmills in Boulder Creek. The plan area is approximately 4.5 miles northwest of the town of Boulder Creek, on a tributary of Boulder Creek, approximately 3,400 feet upstream of the confluence. The registered professional forester is Brian Bishop. The plan has not yet gone to first review. The plan was originally submitted on November 30th and put on hold and return to correct the location of the plan relative to the town of Boulder Creek. The notice of intent said the plan was northeast of Boulder Creek, when it is in fact northwest. So much for details. You would figure that a registered professional forester who's had at least 4 years of college and 3 years of on-the-ground experience could read a compass. The Lago Marcino Timber Harvest Plan has some new information. On December 2nd, Roy Webster, the professional forester, submitted responses to questions raised during the previous 30-day extended comment period for this plan in San Mateo County. The THP 1-08-063 SMO plans to harvest 10 acres of old-growth redwood, not very well disclosed in the original submission. Department of Fish and Game has asked for retention of many of those trees. The Center for Biological Diversity and Sierra Club and the Central Coast Forest Watch have submitted extensive comments as well. One of the key issues brought up was that the harvesting of old growth could have adverse effects on greenhouse gas emissions and global warming. The forester responded by submitting material quoted from a Green Diamond timber harvest plan. In addition, he did calculations of greenhouse gases based on some undisclosed methodology utilized by Sierra Pacific Industries. Cal Fire joined in with Deputy Director Bill Snyder submitting comments in support of the RPF's proposal, with a finding that harvest of old growth will have no adverse effects relative to carbon sequestration. I have been informed informally that Cal Fire that the comment period will be reopened for another 30 days, but that announcement and the new close of comment have not yet been posted on the FTP site. And you can find that site by going to the Cal Fire website and hunting around for it. It's not very easy to find, but it is there. And the San Vicente Creek Stream Enhancement, the Resource Conservation District, in conjunction with the National Marine Fisheries Service, Balance Hydrologic, and other consultants, recently completed the second of two stream enhancement projects on San Vicente Creek. That's near Davenport. The earlier project in 2008 altered a side channel to the inlet into an egg pond just east of Highway 1. This pond has turned out to be an excellent rearing habitat for coho and steelhead, and substitutes for the missing wetlands lost when the Highway 1 overpass was originally constructed. Unfortunately, there were problems with consistent stream flow to the inlet into the pond and sediment deposition into the side channel in the pond, so National Marine Fisheries Service, with assistance, designed a channel modification which allows year-round flow and lessens sediment deposition into the channel and pond. A complex weir system has been created to slow the flow, allowing sediment to deposit and be redirected prior to entering the pond. The more recent project this year was completed a short ways upstream from the pond. An off-channel abandoned agricultural pond was fitted with large wood along the banks to create undercut habitat. The pond is fed by a small tributary and also now receives backwater from the mainstream. Additional large wood was installed at the mouth of the pool or pond area, mimicking a beaver dam. This allows for a healthy pool with low step flows, beneficial to juvenile coho salmon. Both projects have yet to experience much weather to see how well they will function and what modifications, if any, will be needed. I'm certain the researchers are making observations during the current storm, and this was written a couple of days ago. It's now ceased raining, of course. And we thank Jody Frediani, forestry consultant for the Santa Cruz Group of the Ventana Chapter of the Sierra Club, for her monthly forest updates. And a key elephant corridor in India and habitat have been successfully protected. After prolonged protests by Ecological Internet, Rainforest Rescue, and other partners, the Indian government has decided against locating a neutrino observatory, an underground experimental physics project in prime Indian elephant and other endangered animal and plant habitat. Indian officials in a new report have decided the neutrino observatory would gravely impact the Mudumalai Tiger Reserve, an important corridor for Indian elephants and other wildlife, and will be moved to a more suitable site. Priya Davidar of Bondicherry University in Bondicherry, India, noted this is a rare victory for conservation in India. Ecological Internet spearheaded and provided the Internet protest platform for a loose coalition of environmentalists and conservation biologists working to block the project. Some 9,000 global Ecological Internet Action Network participants from 96 countries sent nearly 100,000 protest emails over the past 9 months. This international action, supported on-the-ground organizing by others, including the Rainforest Information Center and noted environmentalists including John Seed, Priya Davida, Ingmar Lee of Canada, who initially proposed the campaign. The area contains one of the largest contiguous forests in Asia and sustains India's largest wild population of Asian elephants and Bengal tigers. The government's report confirmed our allegations that the site is in close proximity to the core critical tiger habitats in Bandipur and Mudumalai, tiger reserves. This is also an elephant corridor facilitating elephant movement from the western Ghats to the eastern Ghats and vice versa. I guess those are mountains. Nilgiri contains over a fifth of India's invertebrates and flowering plants, 15% of its butterflies, and numerous endangered species. Ecological Internet has again demonstrated the importance of ecologically aware global citizens joining together to protest on the Internet in support of local conservation protests. We are very pleased to have been filling this role in the global movement for ecological sustainability for 10 years and hope to continue doing so Should our current end-of-year fundraiser be successful, notes Dr. Glenn Berry, Ecological Internet's president. And if you'd like to find out more about this and perhaps donate, go to forests.org. And I'm going to take a little break here for a sec. And green groups are clashing over reliability of forest-based carbon offsets. Really nasty little problem that's coming up here. Part of the cap and trade. Anyway, this story is by Jessica Lieber, L-E-B-E-R, I guess, of Climate Wire. The environmental group Greenpeace is attacking the legitimacy of a 13-year effort to produce carbon credits by saving Bolivia's rainforest, an effort that other advocates defend as a pioneering and vitally necessary model for fighting global warming. The scene for the dispute is the northeast Bolivia's Noel Kempf Mercado National Park. In 1996, the government revoked 4 logging concessions to double the size of the protected area. The move saved a swath of trees about the size of Connecticut from being cleared by locals to farm or being degraded by timber companies. Nearly a decade later, American Electric Power, BP America, and PacifiCorp, the project's main financial backers to the tune of $8.5 million, sold half of its first independently audited carbon savings on the voluntary market. It was one of the first and is still today one of the largest scale efforts to measure and verify forest carbon credits. At issue is the extent to which similar projects measured and credited on an individual basis outside of national scale programs can reliably reduce carbon emissions. At stakes are billions of dollars of relatively cheap carbon offsets that could be traded for greenhouse gases released from industrial smokestacks in developing countries. Greenpeace, in a report to be released, calls the Noel Kempf Climate Action Project an example of the fundamental flaws inherent in such attempts. The group points to the struggles that the current project planners have had in quantifying actual beyond-business-as-usual carbon savings. They also criticize the project's insurance against the prospect that avoided emissions might move elsewhere or against the trees simply burning down as not nearly enough. These issues can't be resolved through tinkering with models or through technological improvements, said senior forest campaigner Rolf Scar. Global warming is just too important to gamble with. I'm not ready to trust that something that has not yet been shown to be reliable will be so in the future. Indicating a deeply different outlook, the Nature Conservancy, NKCAP's main broker and one of the world's largest conservation groups, strongly disputes the notion. This is really a case of trailblazing, said Serene Marshall, the Conservancy's deputy climate change director. She called the project begun at a time when forest carbon science was nascent and there was no precedent for structuring such deals, a successful learning process that has shown a path for improvements but has also unambiguously proved that these projects can work. Other environmentalists back her up. Doug Bucher of the Union of Concerned Scientists said that while there have been substantial difficulties along the way, the project has shown that it is possible to model, estimate, and make corrections for carbon-saving uncertainties. There is no dispute about many of the specific figures that Greenpeace relies on. It is more in how they are interpreted. Originally, for example, scientists estimated that the 30-year project would save 10 times the 5.8 million tons of CO2 that they figure today. The first projections were revised downward 3 separate times. Greenpeace takes this as a foreboding sign that emission savings are difficult, if not impossible, to pin down. Marshall, however, said these adjustments are indications of how much the science and on-the-ground measurements have improved over the last decade, and how serious efforts to ensure are serious efforts to ensure legitimate credits. Among the number of other issues, the groups also do not see eye to eye on efforts to account for carbon leakage or the transfer of carbon emissions elsewhere due to reduced timber supply from the logging concessions and carbon permanence. The real difference is Greenpeace's distrust of the models and data that form the basis for the project's insurances. Greenpeace says, for example, that the project's estimates of an unavoidable leakage, a total of 16% of emissions, are far too low. I think you get to a point where you have to take a leap of faith, said Scar. Marshall also noted that the leakage number is on the low end of possible ranges, which he said is what top economic modelers agreed upon after studying Bolivia's influence on global timber markets. Those leakage factors were lofted up the top of the total emission savings before the tons were sold as carbon credits. The underlying issue beyond the specifics of NKCAP is whether carbon offset funds should be directed to individual projects. Practically everyone involved in the debate agrees that countrywide programs that measure deforestation against a national baseline are better because they eliminate carbon leakage within a country's own boundaries, a fact that the NKCAP experience effectively demonstrated, said Boucher. In the United States, for example, a House-passed climate bill and the draft Senate climate legislation both heavily restrict international forest offsets to nationally based programs. The bills, however, also allow certain time-limited exceptions for small countries and states in Brazil and Indonesia to submit individual project credits into the market. Many environmentalists believe that the private capital of the offset market will be sorely needed for, in addition to government funds, to build developing nations' capacities to monitor and manage forest carbon programs. It's going to take some time to establish national baselines. If you don't allow people to get credit for investing in national forest conservation where appropriate, you're just going to keep losing forests, said Glenn Horowitz, Washington director of Avoided Deforestation Partners, a group that facilitated the creation of a coalition of major environmental conservation and business groups lobbying for the inclusion of tropical forests in climate legislation. The Nature Conservancy, a member of the coalition along with AEP, Duke Energy, and the Union of Concerned Scientists and others, agreed. Marshall said that private investment in so-called subnational project-level approaches will be critical to help developing countries like Indonesia eventually implement and scale major national programs. It's a daunting challenge, she said. The Bolivian government, for example, has not yet gotten organized enough to sell its own half of the carbon credits from NKCAP. To the detriment of the indigenous populations who live near, in, and around the park, slated to receive a yet unspecified share of the proceeds. Greenpeace takes issue with the entire offset approach. Scar said that ideally, only governments, not private companies that want to compensate for their own smokestack emissions, should fund bonus forest carbon projects. The trade-off for the climate, he says, goes beyond apples and oranges, but in the nearly certain event that international forest offsets make it into a U.S. cap-and-trade program, he said, they should without exception be tied to national baseline programs. With companies like AEP set on ensuring that a large enough supply of offsets credits exist, Scar said that projects like Noel Kempf cannot be trusted. A similar debate is also occurring at the international level as countries work to frame a forest carbon agreement as part of the new climate deal. Horowitz, who also served as Greenpeace's media director until earlier this year, fired back against his former employees, who he said successfully campaigned to entirely bar forest projects from inclusion in the 1997 Kyoto Protocol. I think Greenpeace should take some responsibility for the fact that we lost 300 million acres of tropical forests over the last 10 years, he said. And that's it for the Earth First Update for this week. The Earth First Update is presented every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.1 FM in Santa Cruz, and at www.freakradio.org on the net. If you'd like to hear a podcast or listen to a rebroadcast of tonight's Earth First Update or previous Earth First Updates, go to the following webpage, www.h2opodcast.com. That's h2opodcast.com. When you get there, click on Earth and select Earth First Radio. And we thank the folks at h2opodcast.com for recording and providing those recorded updates for our listeners. Earth First Updates are a project of Earth First Radio and are produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. We thank you for listening and do tune in next Thursday night at 9 o'clock for another edition of Earth First Updates.